Hi, I'm Leanne Ward.
And I'm Susie Burrell.
And welcome to The Nutrition Couch, a weekly podcast from two of Australia's leading dietitians, bringing you everything that is new in the world of nutrition, diets, and good food. From The Nutrition Couch today, we're chatting about another viral TikTok trend, the baked oats. And in our clinic, our clients are asking us about the pros and cons of intermittent fasting. Now to our most popular segment, the supermarket product of the week. We discuss a new plant-based frozen meal option, and our final segment with our listener question is all about diet soft drinks. Can we drink them, and are they actually good for us? And how many drinks is too many? But first, Susie, how's your week been going?
My week has been pretty good. We're at the end of school holidays now, so I'm sure many parents are at the end of their tether with the children. I've really tried to keep as active as I can with the kids, but one thing that tends to go out the window when I am doing a lot more of my own childcare is my own activity, because my kids are too young to kind of come for a run or come for a walk. So I sort of am really looking forward to things getting back to normal and packing the school lunch boxes and putting those posts up, but getting back into my own exercise regime. And it's always a good reminder, I think, to us as clinicians about the challenges busy people have when it comes to balancing their own nutrition and their exercise. And I think it's not that people don't want to eat well or exercise, it's just that the family demands and work demands can be so great. So rest assured, I'm very, very aware that it's a juggle for all of us and we do the best we can with what we can at the time. And I, for one, am really looking forward to getting out there and pounding the pavement when the kids are back to school. So bring it on, the end of the school holidays.
Definitely. And then this week, Susie, what is trending in the media? It's another TikTok trend. I know we've done a few TikTok trends on the podcast. You know I'm all for TikTok trends. This one was baked oats, Susie. How can we not talk about baked oats? They look freaking delicious. But how healthy are they actually?
Oh, this is an ongoing issue, I think, because whenever we put on our social media any kind of baked product, whether it's muffins or cookies or in this instance, oats and TikTok, and I'm paying a lot more attention to TikTok and what's going on there, is that people go crazy for it. We love sweet treats. We love perceived healthy baking. And so when this came up on my media feed as a news item, I clicked very quickly and, of course, was lured in by the gorgeous photos of skillets, you know, with chocolate bits and maple syrup and banana and runny peanut butter. Like, I completely understand why it's so popular, because it's really our love of food and things that not only taste great but are visually beautiful. And of course, we can curate baked oats in particular in pans to look so gorgeous on the breakfast table. So I, like everyone, loves a little bit of food porn, and I do like it. But, you know, when we put our nutrition hats on, you know, a closer look at the ingredient list can reveal that they can be really packed full of fats and sugars. And as a reference point, if you make yourself a bircher bowl or an oat bowl, or in this case, the baked oats, and you, as a few ingredients, you put in some oats, you might put some yogurt base or a little bit of milk to blend it. You might then put some nut spread. You might put a few chalk bits to make it look pretty. You might then add a maple syrup and then banana. Like, you could be looking at 60 to 80 grams of carbohydrate in a single serve, not the whole tray, just a single serve, so a small bowl, which would be pretty close to what some people need for their entire day. So the issue with these kind of products is when we super layer all of the ingredients, you get a super layered calorie effect. And for most of us, we're often not burning it off. So just be mindful. These do tend to really be treats as opposed to daily foods. And if you make it for a beautiful Instagram picture or for your TikTok, give it away, because very few of us will be burning off that amount of calories and carbohydrates in many of them. But it's not lost on me. I think they're beautiful as well.
But a whole skillet of, you know, choc chip oats. Let a reminder, do we regularly eat choc chips for breakfast? Probably not. Do we regularly encourage chocolate for breakfast? Probably not. That's probably the first indication that maybe these are a bit more of the food porn side of things and the health side of things. But I have made my own healthy versions of these, Susie, and I would say that they're a lot more macro friendly than the trending ones you've seen on TikTok, where I just use whole grain rolled oats. I use some skim milk. I use either banana or eggs to bind it, and then some fresh berries inside it. And then I bake that up. I slice it up pretty calorie controlled, around sort of 350 calories per slice. And then I'll serve that with some high protein yogurt. So I'm getting in, and maybe some chia seeds inside that as well to help bind the oats. So I'm getting in some healthy fats, some fiber, some carbs, and some protein. Compared to, I think, a lot of the recipes online are oats, milk, honey or maple syrup. They've got choc chips in there. They're then slathered in maple syrup, or there's ice cream on top and there's more chocolate on top. I've even seen varieties, Susie, where they have this hard chocolate shell. So they're like chocolate shell baked oats. So they melt down chocolate plus coconut oil together. They melt it. They pour it over the top of the baked oats. They put it in the freezer and it creates this hard chocolate shell that then you smash your spoon through. Like, it looks amazing, but at the end of the day, it's probably more of a dessert than it is a really nourishing breakfast option.
Well, when I just put it in the search engine, the first thing that came up was whether it was cake or not. So definitely it assumes the profile more of cake, and think of that with your portions. But again, I couldn't have said it better myself. If I was adjusting it to be a bit healthier, I would probably opt for berries, which you can get frozen at a good cost price point at the moment to help lower the carbohydrate content a little bit. There is an increasing range of lower sugar or syrups that are using a sweetener instead of sugar itself. So I know maple syrup, you can find one with no actual sugar in it, which makes it a much lighter option. And, you know, with the chopped bits, you can place 3 or 4 or 5 to present the bowl or the bake tray looking beautiful. You don't have to pour the packet in, which of course is the temptation. So I would say it's all about portion control or doing it for a special occasion. And of course we love to see beautiful food, but there's always ways we can healthify it a little bit. And portion control is one of the key things, and using the lower sugar syrups and lower sugar fruits will instantly reduce the calorie load of those more indulgent baked oats trays instantly.
Absolutely. And I don't think anybody really, unless you're an Iron Man, needs an entire skillet of baked oats for breakfast. So I think just watch your portion sizes on those things. I prefer to bake them in almost like a lasagna dish, Susie, and then I put them into like 6 slices. That's sort of my preference. And then I get sort of some meal prep for breakfast for the week, and I can freeze a few portions as well. I think just making it in a 1-pan skillet, I know skillets are very American things. So maybe for our Aussie listeners, it's really those, like, what would you call it? Like a deep...
It's like a heavy pan. Kind of like a La Crusoe pan. It's that sort of heavy one. And in America, you're like, right, they tend to be really black and individual. But I like
bake
to
bake them.
I like to serve them in ramekins. You know how you get like the little ramekins you'd put on a serving tray? And I think that's another way of doing it as a portion control for a special occasion. Or if you did a healthy version, just keeping your portions. Because I find, and actually what we know from the behavioral science is what we serve or what our food comes in is what we will eat. They're the portions. So if you prepare a whole skillet or a whole pan, you will eat it, whether it's going back and having an extra spoon here or there, or the portions that you serve are bigger. So it really is limiting portions in any way you can, because human beings are programmed to eat what food is readily available and in front of them.
Absolutely. And just think about baked oats. If you're using oats and milk and maple syrup and bananas and then adding chocolate chips into there, you've got an enormous load of carbohydrate going in first thing in the morning. If you're not someone that's very active or hasn't done a lot of exercise in the morning, that huge load of carbohydrate probably isn't going to be burnt off very well. It could cause a big energy slump or more sugar cravings throughout the day. So my recommendation for the baked oats is always to serve them with some protein. So whether that's some low-fat cottage cheese or some high-protein yogurt, just to help the digestion of that carbohydrate to slow down a little bit. When we serve things with protein or fiber, we can actually slow the digestion of the carbohydrate. So my preference is to always serve some sort of baked oats with some high protein yogurt or another protein source to really just optimize, I guess, the macronutrient profile in that meal.
And if you're a cottage cheese lover, if my clients come and tell me they love cottage cheese, I'm so happy, because I can use that in so many foods, and that's a perfect example. There's also quark, which is that sort of Scandinavian, European, really tart yogurt, which again is really, really high in protein and works really well. Or as we spoke about on the podcast a few back, there's a growing range of higher protein Greek yogurts, which is fantastic. So that is everything that we know on the TikTok baked oats. But another thing we wanted to really chat about, it's come up time and time again, and we've been getting a lot of questions on it online, is about fasting. And I guess when I trained more than 20 years ago, we had never heard of fasting, not in a positive way anyway. And of course, the work of Dr. Michael Mosley a few years back and the 5-2 diet saw the complete shift in mindset around quite severe calorie restriction to induce some metabolic changes and support weight loss and positive metabolic change over time. And now it's become the norm for clients to come in and have tried fasting, intermittent fasting programs. The common ones, of course, are, as I've just mentioned, the 5-2, where you have 2 non-consecutive, especially low-calorie days, 500 or 600 calories, and that appears to have some metabolic benefits and secondary benefits based on weight loss. And then what I call the bastardized version, which is the 16-8, which is where you have an extended period of time without eating, which again appears to have some benefits when it comes to resetting some of those hormones. There's definitely a number of pros and cons that we can look at. And I think it's a really good time for us to discuss it in general, because I know a lot of you will have questions about it, who it's right for, how often we should do it, how long we should do it for, should we be doing it at all? So what are your experience? What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, so let's maybe start with first who it's not for. So I would say anyone who does a really heavy training load, like professional athletes or someone, even if you're training twice a day, intermittent fasting is not for you. If you're a morning training person, intermittent fasting isn't for you. You should not be training on an empty stomach and then fasting for an extended period of time after your training session as well. You're not doing your body or your muscles any service in terms of the proper recovery that it needs. So look at your type of training. If you're someone who's an afternoon or a night training person, maybe some intermittent fasting might be okay for you. It's absolutely not appropriate for pregnancy or breastfeeding. And anyone who has a background in, as an eating disorder or with disordered eating or restrictive style eating, absolutely not for you as well, because intermittent fasting can very quickly lead to basically just restrictions and down that path of disordered eating. So they're the people that I would say definitely not for. If you are a diabetic on insulin, you could do some intermittent fasting, but absolutely important to link in with your healthcare professional to be regularly checking your blood sugar levels throughout the day as well. Anyone else you could probably think that perhaps it wouldn't be appropriate for, Susie?
I'm with you. I think for anyone who has a history of disordered eating and extreme dieting, promoting the 5-2 has a number of negative side effects psychologically to try and adhere to that level of restriction. Now, let's be very clear. When we look at the data, the evidence base around intermittent fasting is primarily around the lower calorie days. So when we take a look at the research, it was primarily for metabolic benefits, so resetting a number of those pro-inflammatory hormones, helping to reduce cholesterol, blood pressure, insulin levels over time, and the weight loss is secondary as the body gets a bit of a kickstart. So a 500 calorie day is really difficult to follow. So it would be, for example, a piccolo coffee, a hard-boiled egg and some leafy green salad vegetables, and then just 70 to 100 grams of chicken breast or white fish with, again, a couple of small plain non-starchy veggies. So it is really tight restriction. It is not easy to do. And so anyone who has a history of dieting and finds that restriction model can be setting them off for a period of dieting is really contraindicated. And for anyone with especially high energy demands, busy mums, people who are trying to work out, juggle jobs, juggle young children, anyone who is training for an hour or more a day, who has a very active job, I would straight away say it's contraindicated. Now, I do use it, but I either use it with people who are very keen to try it and don't have that history of dieting, or people who need to kind of reset their diet. So they're used to chronically overeating, and having a low calorie day can be a great way to reset them and remind them what it's like to be hungry. And it can also work really well for people who have very sedentary lifestyles, because they're not getting that hunger and they're not burning a lot of calories. Now, a lot of clients prefer the 16-8, which is where you have 16 hours overnight usually without food. And what that does is, again, try and get you back in touch with your natural hunger signals. It means that you naturally control calories because you're eating in a smaller period of time. And that is a regime that you would be encouraged to do most of the time. So it's not something you dip in and out of the way you would the 5-2. And the issue I have with that is that I find people get used to it over time. And while they may get results initially, those results tend to reduce over time as their body gets used to it. And I think if you're hungry in the morning, it's not a good idea to try and avoid eating breakfast because you're trying to get the benefits of fasting. So I would really use it while it's working, but when it stops, I would not feel bad about going back to eating breakfast when you're actually hungry in the morning. And so I sort of use it as a tool to get people over a weight loss hurdle, to perhaps get them back in touch with their hunger if they want to try it, if it fits in with a sedentary lifestyle. But it's not something I prescribe for everyone. It's the case with diets. It's not a one-size-fits-all model. And there's got to be a reason and a benefit associated with doing it rather than a blanket prescription for all people.
Completely agree. And I've never prescribed the 5-2 intermittent fasting. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the research is really in that obese population with metabolic conditions, isn't it? That research is really strong in.
It's interesting with fasting because the cellular benefits that come from extended periods of time without food are of anti-aging benefit to all of us generally. It helps to keep our hormones like insulin under control. But you're right, when we look at the research, it's generally done with overweight and obese people who are specifically looking for those very pronounced health-related benefits. It was never written as a weight loss program. The weight loss effects are secondary to that. So people will say, oh, it's an anti-aging strategy. Yes, to a certain extent, but we've known for a long time that human beings eat too often to allow those hormones to get back to baseline levels. We don't go generally for longer than a few hours without eating when the human body really can tolerate 4 or 5 even longer without bigger meals. Or if you do eat more at night, again, you probably don't need to eat a bit later in the day, which is what we've discussed before. But our lifestyle has meant that fasting can be a really powerful way to balance out the extras that go into our day-to-day life. So, but you're right, it is generally based for those metabolic benefits and the weight loss can be secondary. But I think, Leanne, it comes back to what we talk about a lot. A lot of stuff with metabolism comes down to change. Mm. And what fasting regimes can do is create options for change and give something, a simple approach people can stick to without having to balance out and count calories at every single meal. So for its simplicity, it can be a really powerful strategy.
Absolutely. And as I was saying, I've never actually used 5-2 for my clients, but I have regularly used something like 16-8 or 14-10 for my clients. Does that add up? I'm not very good at maths. Yeah, 14-10 for my clients.
You're good at
maths.
But
I must say, thank God for calculators is all I can say. But with the 5-2, I do find that that's overly restrictive because I only work with females and a lot of my females or some of them do have a background of just calorie deprivation and some sort of restriction. I find the 5-2 is just a bit too hardcore for my liking. I don't tend to use the 6-8 in terms of the rigidity of the time. Like I say to my clients, if you wake up, they're not training in the morning, so that's fine. They don't feel hungry in the morning. Some of my clients have been flight attendants or they're lawyers who are working like 14 or surgeons, 16-hour days. They don't have time to eat breakfast. They're not hungry. They're in at work at, you know, maybe 4, 5 a.m. in the morning. I say eat when you're hungry. So whether that's after a 12-hour fast or whether that's after a 16-hour fast, I don't get caught up in the numbers or the rigidity, which I feel like unravels a lot of people, Susie. So 16-8, I've seen people literally, when I used to work at the hospital 3 years ago, this was very popular fasting, I would see nurses like counting down the seconds till 12 p.m. until they could eat. And I was like, that's just ridiculous because you get to the point where you feel so hungry that you almost feel sick. And then when you do start eating, you're inhaling your food, which is not good for anyone. And again, the weight loss benefits of fasting are going to come from generally eating in a smaller eating window time frame, therefore eating less food, therefore eating less calories and losing weight. But if you're going to stuff yourself stupid because you've just fasted for an hour or two longer than you probably should have to create that just starvation effect, you're then going to eat 3 times as much as you normally would at lunchtime and undo all the benefits of the calorie deficit that you may have had. So I really think that don't be too rigid around the actual time frame. Anything more than a 12-hour fast has been shown in the research to be beneficial because, as you said, most of us will graze long into the night, wake up and eat first thing in the morning, and we're barely getting in a 12-hour fast, if that, when that was never even considered fasting. You know, how many years ago was I at uni? That was just considered a normal eating pattern. We stopped eating dinner around 6 or 7 o'clock. We didn't have dessert. We didn't graze and watch Netflix for the rest of the night. We woke up maybe, you know, had breakfast when we kind of felt hungry. These days, it's like we've been conditioned to just eat the minute that we wake up and eat right until we go to bed. We're just eating far too much. We're eating far too often. And there is a small amount of research, mostly in animal studies, I will admit, but I'm really excited to see where the research goes in the future around some gut health benefits as well for extended periods of fasting, because you're just giving your gut time to rest. And for a lot of people with irritable bowel, gut health problems and intolerances, constantly putting food into your gut and overloading it before it's had time to process and digest what's there is not going to do you any benefit. So I do use a little bit of intermittent fasting from a gut health strategy perspective with my clients as well. I'll admit the science isn't quite there yet. It's quite strong in animal studies, but we really would like to see more human studies in terms of gut health benefits and fasting. But I'm definitely a fan. I just don't think it needs to come with the rigidity of the 16-8 time frame or the 5-2. I just think learning to listen to your body more should be the biggest thing that we're really looking for in terms of intermittent fasting and learning to eat when we're hungry.
I have to laugh because you said with lawyers, because when I think about it, I think that the times I've used the 5-2, and primarily I'll use it to get people off a plateau. So they might have been reducing calories or increasing activity, and then all of a sudden we might have lost 5, 7, 10 kilos and they're plateaued. And I sometimes use it as a little trying to break that cycle and just do two lighter days and often in line with when they're less active. But I think a significant proportion of those people, one's a contact tracer. So she works in Brisbane and she'll spend many hours sitting down. So she'll often fast on those days because she finds it keeps her hunger away a little bit. Now she's used to it. And lawyers, I do use it with my lawyers who are doing those really, really long days and they can't be active and they find it easy to keep their focus up if they keep off heavy food through the day. So that made me laugh a little bit because their lifestyle can be so sedentary when they're working on a big case. But definitely it's a strategy that I use. It's not a default prescription that I give. And I'm like you, I'm trying to get people to at least have 12 hours overnight without food. And probably the group that I may use 16-8 with is my insulin resistant group who don't feel any hunger in the morning. And so as I try and reprogram their hunger and shift it earlier, I may say, look, I want you to try and extend that fast overnight just to try and get back in touch with those appetite signals and get you hungry. And then over time, I'll reduce it back down to maybe more like 12 to 14, which is sustainable because, yeah, it's about fitting the right approach to different people. And in terms of longevity benefits and health benefits, it's interesting you spoke about studies with rats or with primates because a lot of the early research in fasting did come from primate studies, which showed that if monkeys had 25% less calories over time, might not be exactly right, so just humour me there, but a significant calorie reduction over a long period of time, they lived longer, so it seemed to have benefits from a cell health perspective. And if you look at what humans are eating, what an average calorie intake of what, 2,000, 2,500 a day, which is when we're in positive weight gain and a lot of us are and overweight as adults, again, if we reduce that down to that 25%, even a bit more reduction, we too would get those benefits without fully starving ourselves. So it's safe to say that giving longer time overnight without food and keeping our calories a bit lower than they are rather than being in a constant weight gain cycle will be very powerful when it comes to anti-aging for all of us without having to go to very extreme regimes.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I was at uni, Susie, 10 plus years ago now, we were really taught that breakfast was one of the most important meals of the day. You know, it helps with focus. It helps with energy. You set yourself up well for the rest of the day. If you don't eat breakfast, you end up overeating at other meals. We know that now that that's simply not the case. Of course, if you're a child or a teenager, we absolutely encourage breakfast. It has been shown to be better for, you know, attention and learning and that sort of thing at school and at university. But for adults, if you wake up and you're genuinely not hungry, there's absolutely no need to eat. Breakfast doesn't need to be the most important meal of the day. So I really do encourage you to just tune into your natural, I guess, hunger and fullness signals, particularly if you've had a big weekend or you've had a big night or you've had a really heavy meal the night before. If you're waking up and you're not feeling hungry, then listen and honor those hunger signals in your body and wait till you feel hungry to eat. It doesn't necessarily have to be a 16-hour fast, which means you need to get to 11 a.m., 12 p.m., 1 p.m., but just if you can hold off on your normal breakfast, which is normally at 6 a.m., and have it at 9 o'clock when you actually feel hungry at 9 o'clock, that's going to do you the world of good just in terms of tuning and listening to your body, let alone any sort of, you know, benefits that fasting might provide. So I think that's probably the biggest takeaway is learning to listen to our bodies and feeding it when it's genuinely hungry, not because everybody else is eating around us or not because the clock says we should eat or not just because it's a bad habit and we've programmed ourselves into doing that.
100%. And having that research switch, particularly after the weekends, if you are routinely having a lot of calories over the weekend, having a light night on a Sunday night or light day on a Monday, or having that sort of extended period of time much longer than you normally have without eating would do your body the world of good.
Definitely. And then Susie, that brings us to our most popular segment, our new and exciting supermarket products. And this week you found us a new plant-based frozen meal. So the brand is Abundance Feel Good Food and you found a Japanese stir fry. Let us know about this one, Susie.
Now, I was so excited about this product because I saw an ad for it. I think it was in Woolies. It was on one of those kind of screens where they highlight new products. And I was so excited because I thought, great, a new stir fry option. This one specifically we're talking about today, it's called, sorry, the Abundance Japanese Stir Fry, but they're in the frozen section and there's several different varieties. And it's so colourful and pretty and it looked great. And I thought, great, another convenient food that busy people can grab and have more veggies. But I was a little bit disappointed because when I actually took a closer look at it, it looked really good, the ingredient list. Like the vegetables come in first with beans, mushrooms, edamame, cabbage, onion, capsicum. It doesn't actually have the percentage on there, which it normally would, and I believe probably should have it on there, how much actual vegetable component. And then the next ingredient after the veggies was cooked turmeric noodles. Now, when I look at the actual nutritional panel, that was giving me 12 grams of protein per serve, which is quite reasonable for a veggie-based dish, almost 10 grams of fat, which is not insignificant for a veggie-based dish, but it was a massive 54 grams of carbohydrate, admittedly almost 5 grams of dietary fiber, but then 1,200 milligrams of sodium. So what's happening, to the best of my understanding, is that, yes, this is a frozen product that has quite a lot of vegetables, but there's also quite a lot of carby noodles in it. And then they're going pretty heavy with the sauce to obviously flavour it up. And that's really bumping up your sodium level. Now, as a reference point, we really encourage people to not have more than 2,000 milligrams of sodium per day. So to have more than half that in a vegetable-based dish with 53 grams of carbohydrate, it's actually not a product I would probably recommend. I'm a bit disappointed because it promised so much. And when I took a close look, I just thought it was pretty carby, quite a lot of sodium, and perhaps not as healthy as I would really like it to be for a vegetable-based product.
Absolutely. And when you sent me that, I was quite excited. The packaging looked amazing. It looked fresh. It looked healthy. It was a vegan-based option. I thought, great. The front of the package says, Japanese stir fry with turmeric noodles, ginger, mushrooms, edamame, and a Japanese seven spice. And I thought, amazing. That sounds great. But as you mentioned, the carbohydrate load is quite heavy. The protein, unfortunately, is quite low. From the photo, I think we established that these are probably mushrooms, but to me, it looked like textured vegetable protein or a bit of tofu or something. So I would ideally like to see a little bit more of a boost in terms of protein, upwards of that 15 to 20 grams for a plant-based meal. It's got a moderate amount of fat in it, close to 10 grams. And the fiber, as we said, is awesome. But if you take a closer look at the back of the packaging, it's got two serves of vegetables in this meal. And I mean, for a plant-based meal, when we're looking at, you know, a minimum of 5 serves of veggies a day, Susie, if not 7, 8, 9 serves for honestly good gut health, it's underrated, isn't it? Really?
It is. And it looks so healthy and pretty. And that's why we were both so drawn into it. So I think the take-home message is that just because a product looks healthy doesn't always mean that it is. And sometimes a quick scan of that ingredient list. And when we look at this ingredient list, you can see there's quite a lot of additives. There's some added sugars, there's some added salts, there's thickeners. Now, if you're cooking a veggie stir fry at home, you might have some extra virgin olive oil in the base of your pan. You might have tons of veggies, even if you're trying to keep it plant-based, or you might throw in some tofu or some prawns to give you some extra protein. And then all I would add is a little bit of soy sauce. There wouldn't be any thickeners. There wouldn't be any extra sugars. So, you know, you can eat really clean at home with very simple products like a plain veggie stir fry and season it up to taste amazing without needing to buy a processed food, which has got more additives in it and more carbohydrate than you would have if you had just made something yourself. And yeah, just because it looks really fresh and healthy doesn't unfortunately always mean that it is. So we do need to be careful.
And the other thing is, it's actually quite lower calorie. Like it's 360 calories for the serving, but that comes with, you know, 54 grams of carbohydrates. So if you're making this yourself at home, which would be super simple to do, I think you could throw this together in 20 minutes or less. I would halve the noodle. I would double the protein. So whether you're doubling the edamame beans or adding in a bit of tofu or a bit of, you know, lean animal protein, prawns or fish or chicken, as Susie mentioned, to boost that protein and really doubling the amount of veggies in that and lightening up the sauce a bit, I think you'd have a wonderful nourishing meal yourself. But I guess frozen meals are important. It's not the worst frozen meal on the market, absolutely. But it probably was a bit of a letdown. I really did think this was something I was going to recommend, give it 5 stars. And it probably, for me, Susie, comes in maybe, I don't know, 3, 3.5 out of 5, put it that way.
I'd give it 3. I'm with you. I'm 3. I was a bit disappointed. I'm with you. I would halve the carbohydrate down to 20 to 30 grams per serve. And that amount of sodium in a veggie stir fry is just way too high. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of soy sauce or a little bit of, if you can, buy salt reduced soy, because it really does pack a great flavor, but also plenty of salt. And that's sometimes why we wake up bloated or thirsty in the nighttime, because that's really, really concentrated. So where you can look for salt reduced versions of your favorite sauces, that's a smart thing to do just to keep our overall salt intake controlled.
And the other interesting thing I thought was the noodles are cooked turmeric noodles. So a little bit of a marketing, you know, people like turmeric, it's supposed to be anti-inflammatory. We do know from the research that we need black pepper to activate the compounds in turmeric to make them bioavailable. So no mention of black pepper on the labeling and no mention of the amount of turmeric. When we look at the research studies, I can't quote Susie off the top of my head what amount of turmeric we actually need for an anti-inflammatory effect, but there's no amount listed on that label either. So again, I would call the turmeric noodles a health halo, something that's in there to perceive it as a healthier choice, but actually no nutritional or science-based benefit for having those turmeric noodles in there. They're just, honestly, they're just yellow noodles at the end of the day, to be honest.
They are yellow noodles, you're right. And just an offside, you're right. 5 grams of fiber for that many veggies is still reasonably low. With a normal veggie stir fry, I'd be wanting 8 to 10 grams. So it's higher, but definitely you could do better yourself at home with a lot less processing and a lot fewer additives. All right. So our final segment. Now, this is one that is going to resonate with a lot of our listeners because it's a question that comes up a lot for me with my own clients. I know I've been partial to a cheeky Diet Coke. Don't get me wrong. I'm not proud of it. But there's a lot of questions we get about diet soft drinks. And this was one that came up on our Facebook account about, you know, diet soft drinks. Are they healthier? Can we still include them? Because I love them. How often should we be having them? So the good news is, I think, around diet soft drinks, and they're all the same in the sense that while the cola varieties we're very familiar with do also generally have caffeine as well, they're basically all sweetened varieties, whether they're using a natural sweetener, whether they're using an artificial sweetener. Different flavors will often just be the use of different flavors through that mix of sweetener. And sure, it may be, you know, inferred that a natural sweetener is better, but at the end of the day, for me, they're still giving your brain this really concentrated source of sweet beverage that over time tends to drive you to want more of that sweet food. So are they better than full strength? 100%, because the research shows that full strength soft drinks, adding 9 teaspoons per can or up to 13 for a buddy bottle, closely linked to weight gain, closely linked to obesity, really bad for the teeth, terrible habit for teenage boys. The less of them we have, the better. So from a sugar perspective, yes, the diet varieties don't contain calories. They're going to be better. But that doesn't give you license, I would say, by any means to drink them, because they have also been linked to some issues with insulin response. People who have them are not necessarily lighter in body weight, so they haven't been shown to support weight control any more than regular soft drink. My belief around that is that it primes you to want more sweet processed food, and I would say an occasional thing to get you through if you really need something, but again, I don't prescribe them, I don't encourage them, and if I've got a client who's heavily reliant on them and say is drinking multiple per day or really looking for it every day, I'm really trying to reprogram their nutrition to not want them and not have them as a routine part of their dietary intake.
Mm. And I'm like you, Susie, I have occasionally had a Diet Coke. If you see me at a restaurant one day and I'm not having a glass of wine, I might perhaps have a Diet Coke while I'm out as a bit of a treat. But again, that's something that I, even though there's no calories in it, I would consider that a bit of a treat for myself because it's something that's, it's nice, it's fizzy, it's sweet, it's filling. But when we look at the research, and I'm sure the latest meta-analysis I read on diet soft drinks was that it actually didn't have any real effect on blood sugar levels, which is great for our diabetics. But as you said, I think what a lot of people do from a behavioral perspective is they replace the full sugar Coke with a Diet Coke, but then it sort of, it always gives them an excuse to then have more sugar a little bit later on. So, you know, that's not really conclusive in the research. So we know it doesn't really affect our blood sugar levels, which is great, but it does kind of, as you mentioned, prime us to want more sweet things later on. It's also not great for gut health because a lot of the artificial sweeteners are what we call those sugar alcohols, and they're just not great for gut health. They can cause a lot of bloating and wind in a lot of people, plus the additional carbonations from the bubbles in soft drinks can cause a lot of bloating and problems for people with gut health too. And just the cola varieties of Diet Coke, I'm not really a fan of because, you know, they're not great for our teeth and they do cause a bit of strain,
erosion, yeah, and stain, erosion, because they're highly acidic.
Yeah, exactly.
Highly acidic and staining, yes.
Yeah, so I think that there are a few varieties, not so much in cafes and restaurants, but if you're looking in the diet soft drink or soft drink aisle, there are a few like diet, sugar-free lemonades and that sort of thing. But my preference is generally for my client, Susie, is something like a low-sugar kombucha. Of course, it's not calorie-free, but sort of 30, 35 calories a can. Whether or not there are some gut health benefits with kombucha, I really do think the jury and the research is still out with that respect. I don't think there's a huge amount of gut health benefits in a can of kombucha, but it's definitely better than a can of full sugar soft drink. So that's sort of my preference for the majority of my clients. But I do occasionally use diet soft drinks for clients who are in a deficit and are feeling hungry, because something like, you know, a great chicken and pumpkin salad with a Diet Coke when they're out at lunch with their friends versus a bowl of pasta and 3 wines is obviously going to be a much better choice. So again, like you, not proud of the fact that I will occasionally use a Diet Coke with clients, but I do think they have a good time and place for the right person, but absolutely not on a regular basis. And if I've got a client who drinks, you know, I don't personally working with private clients these days, but I used to when I worked in public health at the hospitals, you know, people would come in with 600 ml bottles of sugar, you know, full sugar Coke and those huge iced coffee things and that sort of thing. And they'd have multiple of them per day. So getting them down off, you know, 1.25 liters of Coke a day, just that direct swap to Diet Coke is a great strategy to start with. And then of course, bringing down that load across the day and across time is obviously going to be a great question. So I think in terms of, are they okay to drink? Yes. Treat them as a treat, put it that way. And I would say, you know, no more than sort of, I'd say once a week. That's sort of my opinion with those sort of diet soft drinks.
And I think if you're routinely buying them, if they're in the house, you'll continue to drink them. So try to stop buying them and actually go and get one when you really want one. Look for the smaller cans. You can now get ones that are just 200 ml. Mm-hmm. So that's much better than a buddy bottle, of course. And I think the other trick is that if you are really craving something like that, you need to eat with it. So you're much better to have a cheese and crackers or some yogurt with it to help neutralize that sugar craving than just have the artificial or the natural sweetened drink that sort of gives you the hit, but then the body realizes you don't have any fuel on board and it's more likely to drive the craving. So don't have them on their own. Always try and have them with food. And you'll notice that changes the taste of them and they're not so palatable. So over time, what we're trying to do is shift your palate away from craving that artificial or sweet flavor, and that will help you keeping much better in control of those cravings. And the other thing, of course, as the weather warms up, Leanne, doing things like the iced teas, using mm-hmm. the tea bag yourself, mm-hmm. and now you can use something like a little bit of stevia to sweeten it if you do an iced green tea or an ice. There's so many flavored teas out there, and programming you to actually add a beverage that's got some antioxidants in it or a much healthier is a good thing to aim for and shift your palate over time away from craving that very, very sweet beverage.
Absolutely. And there are a few good ranges of, you know, low sugar mineral waters on the market as well, like sparkling mineral waters. And I'm quite partial to just a soda water with a small squeeze of lime and some fresh mint or some fresh basil in it as well. Particularly if I'm out and I'm choosing not to drink, that's my drink of choice. I'll get a soda water with some, you know, fresh lime and a bit of herbs in it or something, which I think is really lovely and refreshing, particularly in summer. So I think there are some definitely better options on the market. I think diet soft drink is absolutely okay to have occasionally, but keep it to the, you know, occasional backyard barbecue or birthday party, or if you're out to dinner with some friends and you're choosing not to drink, don't make it a regular thing where, you know, every single night you're popping a can of Diet Coke with your dinner, because again, that tolerance to it, you'll just want more and more and more over time. And then that becomes a daily habit and a twice daily habit and a three daily habit. And then before you know it, you've got a caffeine addiction plus a, you know, artificial sugar-free soft drink addiction as well.
100%, 100%.
Wonderful. Well, Susie, that brings us to the end of the Nutrition Couch for another week. If you haven't done so already, listeners, don't forget to subscribe to us to have us delivered in your inbox every Sunday morning. And we would absolutely love and appreciate if you could leave us a 5-star rating in the Purple Apple Podcast app. And please do make sure if you love the podcast, you're subscribed, because the subscriptions are really what drive our ratings in the charts. So the more people that subscribe, the higher up the charts that we rank and the more we can get our great messaging out to people all around the world. So we'd really, really appreciate it if you guys subscribe to the podcast. We do have Instagram and Facebook social sites running. We're at the Nutrition Couch Podcast. Send us your questions, feedback. We will pop the photos of product reviews up on our Instagrams and Facebook as well. So make sure you go and check them out. And guys, we will see you next week, same time, same place. Thank you for listening.
Have a great week.